Good evening.
Good evening.
Excuse me. Good evening.
Yes.
You are listening to The Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only.
Only.
Microbroadcasting radio station. I am Nicholas Miller here
Hi.
With Steve Cato.
Yeah. Hi. How are you? I'm Steve Cato. Are you you doing okay? You you getting a thing with your throat or like a cold or something?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. My throat has been a little scratchy. I think, you know, anytime the weather changes, my sinuses
just go nuts.
I was gonna say they revolt, but you know, I don't really understand the will of sinuses. Maybe
right.
Launching mucus down my throat is extremely joyous for them. So maybe I could just say, when the weather changes, my sinuses party.
Yeah. Right.
Feels like a revolt to me. Feels like they're not doing what they were meant to do by whoever made them.
Yeah, what are they for?
But yeah, oh, that's a good point. They were meant to protect me in some way.
Really?
Oh, yeah, goodness.
Oh,
well, speaking of protection, we'd like to begin
right.
this episode with a public service announcement. Please, those of you that live within the broadcast area covered by K-Chung Radio, beware. There is an arsonist.
There is an arsonist.
Afoot in Chinatown who has burned several cars.
Mm-hmm.
Many of you saw the coverage by Leroy's Happy Place
mm-hmm.
last week. I can attest this morning that a car was set ablaze just in front of the Bernard Street cul-de-sac.
No way.
Tucked in the armpit of the Chinatown exit of the 110 and the 110
fuck.
Itself.
Yep. Holy shit.
Burned to smithereens. Please, be careful. I don't really have any good advice. Lock your car up if you can. Take the train to work.
Yeah.
Do whatever you can to stay out of the rain of fire that this person is launching all over Chinatown.
So disturbing.
Let's hope those gentlemen with the hats and the red shirts and the segways do their job and get these arsonists. Yeah.
Oh, it just takes property to turn you into a
it's
cop.
It's a terrible thing.
Yeah. Well.
Right. Well, we have a rather long bit of talking.
Mm.
We've tried to talk to our host. Sorry, not really host, but there's two gentlemen talking. We tried to talk to both of them. Told them to keep it down, but they've clearly been drinking. I don't
uh-huh.
think it's going to work out. It's a rather taxing episode for Steve and I because we've decided to invite our close competitor in East LA talking. Mr. Mark Maron. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
He's already got a platform, folks.
If there's anything that seems to be the antithesis to the gentle,
art-focused,
thoughtful nature that we have here on The Talking Show, it would be Mark Maron. But
yeah,
you have to be open in these times, you know, open to all
Do
sorts
we.
Of things, including toxic masculinity. Okay, fair. Maybe you don't have to be open to it, but
no.
we're going to give it a shot.
All right.
So tonight,
Jesus.
Here on The Talking Show, amidst a sprinkling of blazing cars, we have Mr. Mark Maron and none other than actor, director, writer, Danny McBride.
You need those? Those are old cartridges.
Printer cartridges down there. It's good.
I like to keep an array of shit so people can kind of play when they get nervous and fidgety.
A wooden stake.
No, this is half a hammer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
of course
sure.
It is.
Yeah, that makes more sense, doesn't it? Got some guitar strings. Anything you need.
A brand new phone.
Sure, you can make a call on the old-timey phone.
I like it.
Do you even have a phone anymore? Do you have a home phone?
No. Walkie-talkies.
Oh, good for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just so the house is that big, you're doing all right for yourself.
Getting it going, yeah.
You just like, I appreciate you coming over. Danny McBride is in my garage. Do you like it? You all right with it?
It's the shit. This is how garages should look. I like it.
Did you expect it to be like this?
It's even more magical than I had imagined. Yeah.
This is my entire life in books and things I haven't read. This is a life lived with aspirations to read things.
It's nice. This is a good place to hide from the rest of the world. I like it.
It's cozy.
Yeah.
Guitars. We're ready to go.
It's great.
So wait, now, where do you live?
I live in Hollywood right now.
Yeah.
Me and my wife live in the middle of Hollywood. We have a 5-month-old son.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're not sleeping?
No, we have a loft, so we know that we need walls. That's the one thing we've learned. With the,
with the kid?
That artist lifestyle goes out the fucking window when you have a 5-month-old.
You're like, we have to stop this noise somehow. Yeah. We need a partition.
You know what? Maybe walls would be good. Yeah.
So you just live in one loft? It's like a what is it? Is it a house or is it the top of
it's
a building?
It's in that old... Yeah,
oh, right, right, right.
Yeah,
I'll bleep that out. I don't need you. You don't want...
My address is 16.
We heard you on the podcast. Hold your baby up. But where did you don't come from. You come from the South, right?
Yeah. I grew up in Virginia. I was born in Georgia. And we actually have a place back in Virginia still. We try to get back there as much as we can.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you got people back there?
I do. My family's all back there. Like, a lot of the guys I grew up with still live back there.
Now, I can't, like, see, I have a thing with the South because I've spent time down there. I'm fascinated with it. I've decided that people that come from the South have a more defined personality because of their regional affiliation with that whole fucking trip down there. Like, am I making sense?
No, you are making sense.
Like,
I get it.
You're a guy, you arrive on the scene, you're like, he's fully formed.
Yeah.
He's got a point of view, he's got an attitude, and it seems to have something to do with the South.
Yeah, well, you know, there's not a lot to do down there, so you have a lot of time to focus on how you're going to be presented to the world when you arrive.
It just forms through driving around in trucks and drinking.
Exactly, and drinking. Lots of drinking.
But you grew up in which part exactly?
I grew up in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is about an hour south of D.C.
Yeah.
Big Civil War town.
Right, they do reenactments,
they
right?
They do. They
or
do
is
reenactments.
That, is that, that's where that happens?
Yeah, the Battle of Fredericksburg happened there. And then, like, you know, I think combined all the wars there, it's like the bloodiest ground in North
right
America.
Right there?
Right there,
just
yeah.
Drenched with American upon American violence?
Comes through the cracks of the walls.
Do you know anything about the Civil War?
You know, when you grew up there, you're forced to, like, learn about the Civil War. I mean, it's like, that's kind of lame living in a historical town because when you're a kid and you go on field trips, you literally go, like, 5 minutes away from where you live. Like,
we're taking a field trip to this guy's house. His backyard was a scene of an amazing execution.
But there's all sorts of crazy history there. I mean, I bartended down in that town for a little bit when things weren't going so cool in Los Angeles, and... I met this guy that, like, well, had, you know, graduated from college there. He lived still in the downtown area. And him and his friends, one day digging in their backyard, started to find all these fucking corpses of, like bones of, you know, humans in there. And they had, like, one of the guys was an archaeologist, and he realized that, like, this was a hospital where they had, like, you know, this is where they really
they
had buried.
Oh,
they
right.
had buried some dead soldiers. And these guys had such a good rate on their rent that they didn't, like, let their landlord know until they were ready to move because they knew it would be claimed by the government.
So they just, when they get high, they bring people out, like, don't tell anybody about this, man. There's nothing but bones in here.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff like that. Like, there's another big deal down there is, like, all those battlefields are there, and you're not allowed to go metal detecting on battlefields. It's like...
It's against the law?
Against the law. You can, like, lose your home and everything. And then I would know these guys who would, like, invest in these night vision goggles, go out in the middle of the night and just try to elude these rangers and, like, to find belt buckles and bullets.
Did they find shit?
Oh, all the time. And they would risk losing their homes just to find bayonet of an old musket.
That's a whole new angle. Like, usually with the metal detector, you picture the old guy on the beach, but these guys are like, no, we got to stay down. They're out there doing, you know, that's hilarious. But, okay, so, now, but what, Like, I don't know much about the Civil War under the other than, like, from my point of view, the right side won.
Yes.
But down there, it's not always the point of view.
Well, you know, it's like, I think the South definitely gets a, you know, obviously, they're, you know, everyone knows what the South was fighting for, and everyone in the South isn't proud of that. You know, the South is a place definitely that isn't the same as it is portrayed, like, you know, 56 years ago. It's
right,
definitely
right.
grown. A lot of people that right. live there aren't from there, didn't grow up there.
Right,
you know.
Right.
I don't even, you go down to the South, I have a younger sister who's just now like 19 years old, and she doesn't have a Southern accent. It's like,
really?
No, they all, you know, like that's something that also disappears.
Everyone, do they give classes now to get rid of it?
To get rid of it from the gate. I think they just watch MTV and they all just sound like they're from the fucking hills. That's what everyone, no matter where they live, sounds
that,
like.
That's true. I think they like the characterization of the South, and I try not to condescend to it too much, but it's always, if someone's going to do a dumb character as a stand-up, so I was like, what's up? You know, it's always that guy. Did you ever know a comic named Killer Bees?
No.
There's a regional comic named Killer Bees. It only works this out. He had a tagline. It's, save up! You better save up! Like, after every...
Better save up.
You better save
Prepare.
Up. Yeah. So wait, now, you were bartending when things weren't going well in L.A., so how many times have you taken a crack at this thing out here?
Tons of times. I moved out here in 99, and right after I got out of film school. And
that was before Foot Fist Way.
That was. The Foot Fist Way was the last escape from L.A., and then it was like, that's the one where it was like, I literally moved out of Los Angeles, like, fuck this town, I'm done with this. And
right out of film school. So is that where you met your crew?
Yeah, that's where I met all the guys. Jody, David Green, all the guys that
right,
I worked
right.
with. Yeah, we all met there.
And that was where?
That was the North Carolina School of the Arts, this little film school that we were like the third class to graduate from there. So it was a brand new film school there.
Yeah, uh-huh. And was that, okay, so that was undergraduate, right?
Yeah, yep.
So you moved out here like right after film school, like, fuck it, I'm doing it.
Here we go. We moved out here like 30 guys, and like after the first 6 months, there was like 10 of us left.
How did they fall off? Like, how? What was the timing? Like, one guy lasts a month? Like, this is, I can't.
I equate it to, like, what it must have been like for the soldiers to storm the beach at Normandy, where everyone's just quiet in this, you know, waiting. Like, this is going to be all of our dreams,
in the
right?
amphibious vehicle?
Yeah.
Right before the gates.
And then you see guys get shot in the water, guys don't even make it to the beach, and that was kind of like what it was like for a lot of my Southern friends when they moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah. You always feel bad for the guy that takes the bullet before the thing even drops
yeah.
open. Just about to get up. Boom, he's done.
He never made it out of his waiting table's job at Crocodile Cafe. Like.
So that's, but it's a hard town. I'm not, can you put your finger on why it's hard? I think it has to do with expectation. I mean, guys who don't, like, who can't handle it within months, I don't know what they were expecting.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you, you know, especially at that school, we're, you know, it's going to school with a bunch of people from that area.
Yeah.
You're so far from the entertainment industry. You have no idea what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
And you're also kind of like, in my town, it's like, I was the only kid I knew who wanted to make movies, you know?
Right.
And suddenly you move to a town where every single person you meet wants to make movies. And that takes a little bit of getting used to
it. It's a sting, right?
Yeah,
because you're special where you come from.
Yeah.
But out here, you're just like, yeah, get online.
Time it doesn't.
Did you write anything? But that guy, David Gordon Green, and your other friend, who is it, Jody West?
Jody Hill. Close.
Jody Hill?
Yeah.
Watch, I'm going to fix it right now. And your other friend, Jody Hill, we just cut that shit, man.
I love it.
But you graduated at the same time and you came out at the same time?
David graduated a year before Jody and I, and Jody and I graduated the same year. And David, he graduated a year before us, came out to L.A., so he kind of was the scout mission. He kind of, like, gave us the lay of the land. And then we came back and shot George Washington, and that's the movie that kind of launched David's career.
Well, it's sort of interesting with him because, you know, he was heralded as this, you know, the next Terrence Malick. This guy's, you know, an art filmmaker, and you dragged him down into comedy?
I fucked his whole thing up. No, he, you know, at school, he made these really fucking weird,
yeah.
strange
yeah.
comedies. Like,
yeah.
My first year of film school, the first thing I ever saw at that school was his film called Will You Lather Up My Rough House? And it was about these two dudes who live together and make soap. And it was just like the strangest, weirdest comedy ever. And so when he got all these accolades for these art films, it was kind of funny knowing that, you know, underneath it's like, you know, this guy is going to make some crazy shit that people are not going to be able to get their heads around.
What did he know that? Is he happier doing comedy?
You know, I think he's the type of guy where I bet you he doesn't do comedies for a while. I mean, I think he has so many weird ideas of stuff. He wants to do Suspiria. I mean, he just wants to kind of bounce all over the place.
Suspiria?
Yeah. You remember
that?
Remember there was like an old Italian film and he's like wants to do a remake of an old Italian horror film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I don't know. I feel like he's going to, I wouldn't doubt him doing a Western, a weird sci-fi. I mean, he kind of wants to bounce all over the
place. He just wants to be like Paul Thomas Anderson.
He's a fucking weirdo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So when you were in, when you're growing up in the South there, well, I'm just trying to picture you because I see I only watch you on television, mm-hmm. see you in movies, so I've decided who you are.
Okay, of course. Yeah.
So I picture you like, come on, fuck it, let's go, and you go out in the truck and you knock mailboxes off and stuff like that with bats and.
This is gonna be super disappointing to you. I drove a Ford Escort.
Oh boy,
red Ford Escort.
Yeah.
I did drama in high school.
Oh, you're not the man that I. Do musicals?
No musicals.
All right, well, at least you drove.
And those dudes that drove the trucks, they would fuck with me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was not.
No.
Like a junior version of Kenny Powers when I was a kid.
So, that's what makes Kenny Powers so appealing is that the little drama guy inside that at the core of all that badass.
The little
is just,
nerd.
Drama, really? So you were at war with the jocks in high school?
I was just a kid who was like, I was just into movies all growing up. Like, I wasn't into sports or anything. I mean, I had like one other buddy who loved movies as much as me, and you know, I would see movies all the time. And drama was just like a weird way of like, all right, this is somehow connected to what I want to do ultimately with, you know. But I kind of always saw myself more like behind the camera. I never really thought I would be involved with any sort of acting at all.
Really?
No, never. And even when I went to film school, I was going there to, you know, direct and write. And I ended up just acting in things for David and ultimately Foot Fist Way for Jody, literally because we just didn't know actors. We had,
right.
had no connection to any actors. And, you know, I had written the script, so I was like, well, I can memorize the lines. That will be one step. You know, we don't have to worry about that part of it.
So you had no sense that you were a comedic powerhouse?
No, not at that age. But now I fully realize this.
You've made some other people money. Mm-hmm. That's a coronation.
Yeah, exactly.
This guy's guaranteed laughs. But what was your family like? What was the racket there? What was it? Did you grow up with any like drama?
No real drama. I mean, it's
or
like
entertainment.
No entertainment. I mean, like the closest thing to entertainment was when I was a kid. We went to church like all the time, and my mom like. Did like puppet ministry. She like did like she what? Would write like these little like, you know, 2 minute little like Bible lessons and then do puppets in front of the church for the kids.
Were they puppets that she made or
they were puppets that she purchased
and bought puppets.
But I think she chose their outfits that they wore and stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
pretty cool.
What religion was that?
We grew up going to a Baptist church.
Really?
Yeah.
So both your folks are Baptist?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, my parents got divorced when I was, like, in sixth grade, and we tried to go back to church, but then everyone was just kind of, they're in the South, they're assholes when you get divorced.
Oh, you didn't hang in. Yeah, yeah. You didn't stick it out.
It was a slow drop-off. Like, we noticed that my mom was just dropping me and my sister off at church for a few months, and then it just sort of like, well, if she's not going, why the fuck do we have to go? And then it was all over.
If she's lost her faith, how is she going to try to convince us that it's the right thing to do?
The judgmental churchgoers won. Yeah.
So, yeah, do you have a relationship with both your parents?
I do, yeah. I mean, I'm closer to my mom. I see her more often, but my dad lives down in Florida. And
Oh, that's already Florida's.
Yeah, it's gross. It's the poor man's California.
I don't know what it is. I have no idea what's going on down there. My mother lives down there, too, and I fluctuate between, like, yeah, this place has got its own thing. It's fucking weird.
Yeah.
And between that and, like, I got to get the fuck out of here.
Exactly. I did some time there for a little bit in sixth grade. I lived in a weird place called Deltona, which is like halfway between Daytona and Orlando, and
it sucked.
It was terrible.
What's his business?
I don't know what he does now. At one point, he was like a manufacturing crossbows, I think, and I'm not sure what the hell his gig is now.
That was a booming, business idea.
Yeah, it really was.
Was he a big ideas guy? My dad's a big ideas guy. Because that sounds like one of those ones you don't follow through on.
No, you don't. I'm not sure how
I'm
well
manufacture
that.
Manufacture crossbow. It's going to be the next big thing. It's been bigger than nunchucks.
It's true. They are.
Well, there's that whole world of hunters that believe in that. Like, it's the righteous way to kill something.
Yeah.
With a crossbow or just a regular bow.
But of course.
A crossbow is the one that you shoot, right?
Yeah, a crossbow, you shoot it. Yeah.
Did you have those in your past?
I didn't. I want one, though. I've always wanted one. Like a double-barreled crossbow I thought would be cool.
And your mom still lives in...
She lives in Virginia, yeah, with my stepdad. And Yeah, and my sister lives there, and I have a younger sister who's in college that goes to college in Virginia. So life is pretty much exactly how it was when I left there. So yeah. There's a few more Best Buys and Targets there.
Isn't that weird, though, that you go, like, I've noticed that a lot because I travel, that there's no place that has any sort of indigenous feel to it. You got to go hunting for, like, the barbecue place. You got to find, yeah, there's one at this guy's house. And you're like, great.
Yes, that sounds unique.
Yeah, that. But you can't find unique experience anywhere.
You can, and especially that area of Virginia. It's like all of northern Virginia, it's like one exit to the next. The towns mirror each other. They just put in these humongous shopping centers that all have the same exact stores.
And yeah,
it's
Walmart,
10 miles.
A Walmart every 20 miles. Yeah, and that's where everyone congregates.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's sad, is what it is. But so you're living here. All right, so let's go back. So you come out here with the crew the first time and just watch your friends, you know, lose sense of their selves and like, I got to go home. And then you split after that. How long did it take you to leave?
Okay, I lived here I managed to stay in for like 2 years, and then I went through a really bad breakup with the girl I'd been dating since college. And then that threw me back. That was the first trip where I went back.
Was she here with you?
Yeah, she moved here with me. And and then she started like wearing like slinkier clothes and everything just went downhill really fast.
You were here to make it. She was here to find somebody who already made it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. When you move here as a young kid, you're right out of film school, you're 21 years old, and it's like there's guys who are 28 and have some real money, you know, and you're still kind of living on like a $25 a week sort of like, you know.
And you realize that you're just there to provide them with new girlfriends.
Yeah, exactly.
You bring out your...
Fell for the trap right out of the gate. And so that was like the first like hit the wall of like, geez, this is tough out here. This is brutal.
Heartbreak and no way in.
Yeah.
It's like you didn't have an agent or nothing, right?
Oh, nothing.
A couple ideas.
A few shitty scripts that you know, I came out with.
And you're eating fat burgers and, you know, wondering how many people were living in the house?
At that point, there were four of us.
Yeah.
And so that was no good. In an apartment in Burbank. And I can remember still the day when I found out that it was over with her. I was working at the Crocodile Cafe in Burbank, which is no longer there, and I went into the manager and just told him, like, I don't think I can do my shift today. I don't know. My girlfriend just broke up with me, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, don't cry, and I start crying in front of this guy who doesn't give a shit, and he's just looking at me, and he's like, all right, just get yourself together, like, go take some time off, and he puts his hand out, and I assume that he's going in for like a hug, but he wasn't. He was going for a handshake, and I'm just like hugging him, crying with my apron from Crocodile Cafe. I remember just walking back to my apartment, just like with my apron like wrapped up in like my white polo shirt with my name tag. It's like, fuck LA, I hate this out here. This is like the worst.
There's so many bad points. There's so many beautifully poignant bad parts of that story. the misjudged hug and then the walk back with the work clothes.
Terrible.
Oh, man. And that walk back with your apron, you're just like, oh, that's it. I got to go. And how long before you split?
So I probably lasted about another 2 weeks. And then I was back to, I moved back to, but this was just temporary. I just knew that I knew I need to get my swerve back on. I was having a really hard time doing that in Los Angeles. So I went back to Virginia and hung out there for the summer, basically, and then kind of saved up some cash, got ready to move back out here and assault this town one more time.
So you went back, you got the bartending job, you got laid, you got your confidence back.
Back in the swing. And then moved out here. And then things were kind of looking up. I got a job as a cameraman doing like motion control for like History Channel and VH1, the type of thing where you're just like zooming in on.
So you're still all about, you know, directing.
Trying to get in there. And at this point, because I'm getting paid to even operate a camera and I have health insurance, it feels like I've made it. You know, I've come a long way.
What were those
cafe?
What were those first scripts like?
Well, the first one I wrote was called
You Came Out Here With
Most Scariest, and it was about these Jersey frat boys who move into a haunted house.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. It would have been awesome. It was like years before Jersey Shore. I knew that those guys would be hilarious.
Yeah,
you know?
But you had a parody of them before they became a parody of themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I was ready. And
had you had experience with New Jersey?
No, I hadn't. I just invented them. Yeah, I knew. I knew it was.
You
right.
were prophetic.
It was the Nostradamus of reality television. I knew that they were going
to
be a hit.
Now, have you called that ex yet, just to say like, hey, what's going on? Remember me?
No, I don't. I haven't wasted any time.
Oh, good for
you. I know. There's just too many things that are embarrassing about that point in my life that I just pretend like it never happened. Each time I move back to L.A., it's like, this is my first time in this city. Yeah,
I did not exist before this time.
You ignore all the people that you used to work with. Like, no, you have the wrong Danny. I'm out here for the first time. I just moved to town.
I heard about that guy that used to work at Crocodile Cafe.
He cried.
It's weird. Yeah, that's hilarious. You're not the Denny McBride that cried at the Crocodile Cafe.
It's not me.
No, I don't know. I've heard that story before. That stands out as a real downfall.
Like that's
your bottom. That's your first bottom.
I hit rock bottom with that, definitely. But when I came back that second time, there was... Everything hadn't necessarily wrapped up with that ex at that point. Something even worse happened with her, which was I got back on my feet. I'm back on my feet in Glendale.
Oh, good. Moved right one town over from Burbank.
You know, starting a new life with me and two of my other buddies who were still out there. And one day, you know, I'm starting, I got a job, I've got things going. I get this phone call. One of my roommates answered the phone, and it's the ex.
Yeah.
And he was not supposed to give the phone to me. I mean, that was a solid rule. But he smiles. He's like, hey, the phone's for you. And this has been about 6 months since we broke up.
Yeah.
She is on the phone, and she's crying. She's
good. Yeah.
Danny, you got to come get me. The guy that I'm seeing just threw me down the stairs and, like, beat me up. You got to come pick me up. I'm just like, oh, I don't want to be with her, but, I still am, like, tortured over this.
Sure.
I'm like, okay, you know, I'm all, like,
you're, like, 21?
Yeah, 20. And I'm ready to do this. I get my two roommates, like, we got to go over there and kick this guy's ass. We're going to go save her. And we get golf clubs out of my roommate's car, and, like, we're driving to Burbank, and I remember, like, Satisfaction was, like, playing. I was like, we can have no hesitation. We have to just, like, pull up and smoke this fucking guy. And we, like, roll up to where she's at. You know, we're, like, looking for the street. It's in Burbank. And we pull up, and she's just standing there on the corner with this dude who's, like, fucking 6'5". He's, like, a personal trainer. He's this huge, muscle-bound dude.
Yeah.
And all of us just stay in the car. We're just like, okay, just come on. You can just come on in the car. You just get in here.
A couple of these. Sorry, man. She just needed a ride.
Yeah, we're here to pick her up. So she goes to the car, and he doesn't let her in. He grabs her back. Yeah. And so I'm in this weird position where it's like, fuck, I got to, you know, okay, I guess I have to get out. So I literally get out of the car. None of my roommates come out. They just hand me the golf club through the window. And so I'm just standing there with the golf club, just like, come on, man, we gotta let her get into the car now, man. And the guy just looks at me, and he's like, what the hell are you going to do with that golf club on? And he's like, comes up into my face. And it's just like, you know, I'm like, I can't believe you hit a girl, man. What's wrong with you? And he's like, what are you going to do with that golf club? It's like this big challenge. So he had challenged me, so I had to do something with it. So I fucking swing back and crack him in his knees as hard as I can. And I just hit him with the shaft. And so it literally just breaks. And he's just standing there looking at me. And I'm holding just the handle of the golf club. And instantly I just try to change something, like, oh, man. I mean, how messed up are you that you would hit a girl? And needless to say, that dude just fucking pounds on me. He just gets me. I mean,
that was it.
Yeah, he's got me on my face. I'm on the ground. I'm getting the shit beat out of me. My roommates are still sitting in the car, just like watching it on. The ex-girlfriend like gets on there, and she's hitting him, gets me off. And then finally, I'm trying to get everyone in the car. We get everyone into the, at this point, it's a Hyundai Elantra. I had upgraded from the Escort.
Oh, good, yeah.
Because I moved to LA. Mm-hmm. I needed a cooler car. And the dude just walks over to the passenger seat, who my buddy, who's sitting there with the most useful weapon, which is a baseball bat, is sitting there shaking in the passenger seat. The guy just comes over, opens up the door, and just grabs the baseball bat out of his hand, and then just starts going to town on my car. And it's just like, oh, Jesus Christ, how did this, like, this whole thing failed? And... And so we get her in the car and, like, get out of there.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, on the way home, it's just kind of like, who the fuck are you dating? Like, what is this? Like, what's happened? And that's when she tells us that this guy knows where we live and all this stuff. So it's like, we're screwed. It's like, we find out that this guy has, like, a criminal record, and he's, like, coming for us. And so me and my friends basically, like, I'm trying to calm my roommates down. They're pissed. Like, why the fuck are you getting us involved with this shit?
Yeah.
And you know, I'm like, it's going to be fine. Nothing's fine. This guy's not going to mess with us. He has his own deal with her. We were just picking her up.
Yeah. Helping out.
Yeah. No, no bueno. Next thing we know, we look out our window. There's like a fucking car of like six SUVs circling the front of our place.
Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, it was nuts. And so like my roommates we're in this really weird apartment complex that was backed up to like the LA River.
Right.
And so these guys, apparently she had taken him on a date to, there was like this parking lot on the other side of the LA River where there was like a little carnival or something. So apparently they had been on a date before. So he knew where our house was from across the river.
Right.
But you had to drive down like a mile to get across and come back up. So we look out. There's all these SUVs. They're screaming and looking up at us, and they burn out. They're going to try to find the place. My roommates are gone. They're out to their car, and I just grab a handful of stuff and like a kitchen knife, and I'm like moving through this fucking apartment complex, you know, and it's like we're like the only white guys live in this apartment complex.
Yeah.
It's all Asian families, and it's just me. They're all eating dinner, and I'm crawling around with this knife looking for my roommates, and end up getting into the parking garage, and I get to my car, but my roommates' cars are still there, and I'm like, fuck, these guys, like, they haven't got out. This is my responsibility, so I'm
got to go back for them?
I got to go back for them, looking for them. We all run into each other, scaring the shit out of each other. It's like, we got in there and literally left and never went back to that apartment for 6 months. Like, we were paying rent there. All of our stuff was there. We were so fucking scared. We just never came back there until we had to move because our lease was up. You know, it was, even to that day, it was like tiptoeing in disguises, like trying to take things out.
Like that dude had a guy there every day. Yeah.
Just like, we didn't know how far reaching his criminal enterprise was. Yeah.
Where'd you end up staying?
We ended up crashing in Hollywood with some buddies that we went to film school with. And that ended up honestly like being like the best thing in the world because we were just living in the valley on the outskirts. And, you know, if you're going to move to L.A. in your early 20s, you've got to do a little time in like a shitty apartment in Hollywood.
Yeah.
At least for a few months.
Oh, yeah. And some people start in the valley. I think the valley is that weird area where it's like it's either going to – that's either you're either going to survive that or you're not.
Yes.
And you left once. Now, did you stay in town that time?
I stayed in that time until the first acting gig I got, which was All the Real Girls. So I was there for like a solid year. Left to go do All the Real Girls, and that was the first thing I had ever acted in.
Yeah.
Green had got that film, and he had an actor pull out at the last minute.
Right.
And so he just called and asked if I would come do it, and, you know, really only based on the fact that we would act in each other's student films, and so he knew that I had, you know, that I would at least have my lines memorized.
Right.
Yeah. That's really what the extent of all my acting jobs have been, is that I could memorize lines. That's it.
And then you left again?
And then I did All the Real Girls, which shot North Carolina, and that was great. Came back to Los Angeles, and then that's when Jody was like, look, I'm sick of... He was working in reality TV at the time. He was doing, like, Road Rules, Real World stuff, and he was like, I'm going to blow my brains out. I got to go make a movie, and that's when he pitched me the Foot Fist Away and was like, would you have any interest in writing this with me? Like, let's... You know, I'm going to go try to pull this off, and, yeah, so then we wrote that script and went down to North Carolina and shot it, and I just between All the Real Girls and Foot Fist Away, I just had such a good time being back in the South, where when you fight people, it's just over, and they don't send, you know, caravans of SUVs to finish the deal. And so I was just ready to kind of get back there and live back there in the South. So, like, after Foot Fist Away, I packed my stuff up in L.A. and was planning on just trying to, you know, make it back in the South. And
well, what was the plan there, really?
I mean, looking back, there wasn't a good plan. There was really just like...
You're like, you know, I can rest my laurels. I did one part. And
yeah,
it was
kind of like also just trying to... I didn't know if I was on the right path. If I was like, maybe I just need to be a writer and just like, you know, fuck, I don't need to write in Los Angeles. Like, if LA's stressing me out.
Did you have the thoughts of like, sort of like, well, there's got to be a local film business here.
Maybe I get into community theater. Who knows? I can shoot industrials. Who knows?
So on some level, you'd had enough again.
Yeah. I think it was just because we had such a good time being back in the South. There's just something for me personally, like every time I get off the plane back in the South, I just feel at ease. I just, you know, just,
because it's where you grew up and you understand things.
You understand how things work.
Like, oh, that guy's an asshole. Yeah. Here he comes. Yeah. Sure enough. But out here, you're like, okay, they're all assholes in hiding.
Yeah.
And somehow or another, I've got to learn how to talk to them.
Exactly. And it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And so I moved back that time, which I thought was going to be for good. And then as soon as I moved back, I found out in November that like Sundance got into that, Foot Fist got into Sundance. And so then it was like, oh, well, you know.
That was the beginning of the role. I mean, in the sense that you hadn't heard anything about it, that you made the movie.
Yeah.
And then he, Jody, went and dealt, you know, did the paperwork, and
exactly.
It got in.
It got in. And then as soon as it got in, everything started to change then. I mean, we got into Sundance, and next thing we know, we're hearing that, like, Will Ferrell and Adam McKay saw the film. And that's really just when everything started to take off. We started, like, that movie just kind of, even though it didn't have a distribution deal from Sundance, it just started getting passed around through town. And we just started, I don't know, they're just, people were just kind of starting to be interested in the stuff that we've been trying to do for years.
Okay, so then all of a sudden it's like you're taking meetings.
Yeah, exactly. Taking the couch tour, getting lots of free bottles of water.
Yeah. Coffee? Anything? You need coffee? Water? Okay, yeah, we get you water. In terms of integrating into this the comedy intelligentsia of this town, so it was Will and Adam that championed that movie, and then did you have any? Because there's a couple of camps. There's the Will and Adam camp. There's the Apatow camp. There's the Stiller camp, and you seem to be roaming freely through them all.
Well, you know, with Apatow, it's like they invited me to the set of Knocked Up, and you know, I'd been a big fan of.
How'd you meet him?
It was once again just through that film. Like, you know, we had met with Adam and Will, and then Judd had seen the film, and I had been honestly following Judd for a while. I mean, things like Cable Guy, I loved
right.
that.
Right, that was a good dark movie.
So, yeah, he invited me to the set, and that was mind-blowing. You know, it was pretty crazy. And, you know, at this point, like, Will and Adam are, like, the only famous people I've ever met in my life. And then a week later, I'm, like, meeting Rogan and, you know, Judd and all these people that I, you know, I've been a fan of. And then it just started, like, everything just started happening, like, super quick. Like, met those guys, clicked with them, and really dug them. And, yeah, it was nuts. It was all happening really, really fast.
So what was it? What was the order of events? So you did Foot Fist Way. You were on Conan, and you did the character.
Yeah.
And then and what was the first big casting?
The first big casting was Hot Rod. That was like the first thing I got. And so I go to Vancouver to do Hot Rod, and then while I was there, I got a supporting role in Heartbreak Kid and in Drillbit Taylor. So I came back from Hot Rod and did both of those films. So, yeah, so it was like in the course of literally like 9 months, I went from, you know, smoking weed and sitting on my couch watching these people on TV to like just being thrown into scenes with them. And yeah, it was pretty nuts.
So what direction did you take your spite and disappointment? I mean, when you're sitting on the couch smoking weed, were you the fuck that guy or the I'm fucked guy?
I didn't hold any anger towards anyone for my failures at that point. I was still enjoying what they were doing.
Yeah. So you were like, I'm never gonna.
Yeah. It was just lying to yourself. Like, I could be a teacher. I mean, why, you know, I wanted to do other things. I mean, I'm a fool for thinking I want to get in entertainment.
So you did that too, like the teacher thing.
Yeah, I actually subbed for
in
a
your
while.
Mind. Oh,
yeah.
You did?
I substitute taught for a while. When I moved back to Virginia that one time, I was bartending at night and substituting in the daytime. And yeah, and I was making an honest living. I was doing it.
And look at you. It's like, I was a real guy for a little while. This is not all Hollywood bullshit. I substitute teachered, and I bartend.
And I think the substituting gig is kind of what spawned Kenny, because the first day that I was a substitute teacher, I was in there, and it was just kind of feeling weird.
Kenny
anyway.
Powers, it spawned it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, you know, I was in there, and for some reason, like, the very first time the first group of kids came in, I, like, had written my name on the chalkboard, doing the shit that I remembered people would do when I was in school.
Yeah.
And, like, I just started unraveling with the first kids. I was, like, kind of introducing myself. And then all of a sudden, I found myself, like, having to justify to these kids why I was a substitute teacher. And just telling them, like, I got real plans. You know, I'm like, this is a fucking stop on the block for me. I'm on my way back out to L.A. after I save up some money. And these kids are just looking at me just like, we don't give a shit.
We're not even listening.
No.
What year were they?
They were high school kids. So those were probably like ninth or tenth graders.
So you felt like you needed to, you know, get
like I needed
cred.
To justify. And then I was like, hey, you know, yeah,
this isn't my full time thing.
Yeah, all they cared about was like, Mrs. McBride, you smoke weed. You know, like all they cared about is if I smoke weed and what kind of car I drove.
Did you give them that information?
I wouldn't. I mean, I would answer the question about the car,
right.
Which none of them were impressed. They all just thought you were bull. Like, what kind of car you drive? And it's like, oh, Hyundai Elantra. And they're like, psh, motherfucker thinks he's a movie star.
This is the weed thing you kind of deferred. I don't think that's appropriate.
No,
conversation.
But I do drive a Hyundai Elantra. Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't impress them?
No, they weren't buying.
So that would be the natural evolution of that. Well, that's a hilarious moment that you know, you feel that feeling like you're still a guy that's that self-obsessed.
Yeah.
That he's still competing with anybody.
Yeah,
kids, doesn't have a baby.
Yeah, it just shows where I was at in my life.
So that didn't last long.
It didn't last long, no.
That's funny, because, I mean, that's weird plan B, because I, you know, if I, in my darkest moments, that's where I go. Like, well, I could teach something. Like, you know, where is, like, now that everything's going good and it doesn't look like it's going to stop, I mean, I imagine that plan B shit kind of fades, right?
Well, it's, no, I'm still like, well, you know, at this point, if it all was over, I could at least teach some sort of college course, maybe, about screenwriting. You know, it's like...
You still think that?
Yeah, I still think about that, you know. Well, if it goes tits up, I mean, I probably could get at least a gig at a community college.
Oh,
maybe.
No, you could probably get a pretty cush gig at a real college on, you know, in a seminar course. You know, just show up once a week,
I would be happy with that, too.
Did you play ball?
No, not at all. I was terrible. It was one of those weird things, too, with the show. Like, I think Jody and I never even really thought about the baseball aspect until after we, like, set it up. And it was, like, a week before we were filming the pilot. It's like, Jody's like, you should probably work with, like, a real pitcher so you can see how to throw. And I'm like, I was like, fuck, I never even thought that I need to know how to throw a baseball.
Ever.
And then we saw, and I was like, oh, and I don't know how to throw a baseball.
You never did any sports in high school or anything?
I ran track and then like...
Really?
Yeah, I ran track and then I was like, you know, a soccer player when I was a kid. Like in the South, I feel like everybody grows up playing soccer, but for some reason they don't end up watching soccer as adults. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. You can watch it apparently. I don't know where it is. I know it's a global sport and we're the last ones on the wagon for that. how did Eastbound and Down develop, though? You just had this character? I mean, what was
Well, it was, you know, with Foot Fist Way, we definitely, you know, Jody and I shot that thing so cheap, and we shot it, I think it was like in 17 days altogether. And it was really the first time, we had written lots of stuff, but that was the first time we had kind of tried to write a comedy together. Because a lot of the stuff I would write was all over the place. I mean, I'd write weird fantasy stuff or horror stuff.
Fantasy stuff, like what? Fairy tale kind of?
No, not Harry fairy Potter tale. Like weird like movies about dragon hunters. And
oh, really?
Weird shit.
You got a dragon hunter script somewhere?
The Draven, yeah. He's half dragon, half man. Yeah.
Oh, really?
It's pretty exciting.
That's the name of the.
Yeah. This would be a huge franchise, of course. The guy who works at Crocodile Cafe wrote this. This would be a huge franchise, Hollywood.
The Draven. Gonna have to get some t-shirts for that, at least. The Draven. What was the horror movie?
The horror movie was like this weird, which I still think is a good idea. It was like back in the, you know, back in New Orleans, in the day when there would be floods, the coffins would like rise up from the ground. They would like float out into the bayou.
Because everyone's buried above sea level.
Yeah. And so they would hire these guys to basically go out in the swamps and like retrieve these coffins. And so it was this like really fucked up Apocalypse Now sort of dark horror film about these guys who like.
Right. You know, who go out into the swamps
to go
for
find
the...
this rich man, the body of this rich man's daughter.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. They're mercenary corpse finders.
Exactly. Yeah. The 1800s. So
oh, okay, so it's dated.
It was a period piece, too.
Oh, good, good.
All the kind of shit Hollywood's looking for from a 19-year-old kid. Period piece.
In an apron.
Yeah, in an apron, crying.
Hey, Mr. Spielberg, the crying kid in the apron. He just really wants to talk to you.
Something
really about his girlfriend
ideas.
and the Draven. Do you know anything about the Draven? Well, fuck, man. So, you, in terms of working with Jody, you guys had not written a straight comedy. He had written some? Or?
No, he hadn't written them either.
Other than the Foot Fist Way.
Yeah, it was just something for us. Like, with the Foot Fist Way, we were kind of like, you know, when we started, we were kind of, it was the world. Like, Jody had grown up doing Taekwondo. He was like, he's like a black belt. And I had taken karate growing up as a kid. So it was definitely a world that we were kind of used to and we knew about. And I think at the time, too, we had both of us really fell in love with the British office. Like, we were, like, obsessed with, like, how, like, just, yeah, like, how funny it was, how awkward it was. And I think for us, it was, like, we want to make something that has that sort of tone where we can balance that line of drama and comedy. And that was really kind of when we started the Foot Fist Way. We were just sort of, like, you know, kind of showing this world that we had both been exposed to, this world of Taekwondo in the South. And we had such a good time kind of writing a character like that that was, you know, just a son
of a bitch. The world was very established and specific and kind of unique.
Exactly.
Right.
And then as we started writing, we just kind of, like, we were making the main character such an asshole. And that really wasn't even our goal when we started. It was, like, just kind of coming out when me and him were working together. And we had such a good time kind of dealing with that, with like trying to like find a main character that is such a shithead, but trying to figure out a way to like find an audience to dig him, that we really want to do it again. Because our time on that was so tight and small, we just felt like we could do something more with it. And instead of trying to set up another movie that would just be like a remake, that's the first thing we kind of pitched to Will and Adam when we met them. We're like, we want to do like a TV show where this is the kind of character that you would get behind ultimately. And it just all started to kind of fall into place from there. We kind of used the idea of me substitute teaching and those sort of weird thoughts I had there of like, all right, well, what if it's a guy who comes back to his town and he was like a hero at some point? It was like, well, why would he be a hero? And we went through all these different scenarios, and finally we kind of landed on, you know, that he was a pitcher. And to us, it was just like, this is a position where the guy's in the middle of center of the game, all attention's on him, and all that goes away, and now he's just at the center of a classroom and he's just trying to act like it's the same thing.
But in terms of being an asshole, it's weird because that character is such a, like, just talking to you now, I mean, you just play it straight. Like, you're just, but, you know, he's clearly at odds with himself and that nothing's going to really work out, but he just keeps plowing along. And that makes him a sympathetic character because an asshole wouldn't be appealing.
No.
But because the guy is so cocky, despite the fact that he's delusional, is what makes it good, right?
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun writing that as well. I mean, just trying to, like.
Did you have those discussions, though, about, like, you know, how's this guy going to remain sympathetic?
At the time we wrote the first series, we didn't even really understand enough enough about what we were doing to kind of like think that that would even be an issue. We just figured like, oh, it'll be funny. People will get along with this. And then as we started going through it, just in the natural process, we started kind of being drawn to the moments where there was like, oh, there's like weakness here. Like, this is kind of interesting. And so it was something that kind of definitely developed as we were doing it. We weren't really sure what we were doing at that point, you know?
But is that something that like, you know, some part of your brain in terms of writing scripts and having studied film that you started to kind of, you know, formulate? I mean, I know you're performing and there was funny there, but in order for it to have some humanity, you kind of,
you start finding those moments of weakness. And that's the kind of stuff that starts to make you feel like you're onto a story that's like worth telling, because it's like when you're right, you know, when you're finding these, like, well, what would make this guy upset? And like, what, you know, how does he show that? Yeah. And that was kind of like for us, what kind of showed us there was like some depth here that we could get away with what we were doing and, you know,
and actually have a human story.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And how did you like the dude who plays your the sidekick?
Oh, Steve Little. Yeah.
Where'd you find that guy?
We found him casting here in Los Angeles. I mean, he was he read for it. You know, at the time we wrote the pilot and, you know, we really wanted to shoot it in North Carolina because we wanted to have all basically just
the
like locals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we did a little bit of casting in Los Angeles, but he was a guy who came in and read and just blew us away. I mean, we loved him, instantly thought he was hilarious. And at the time, we didn't even know what that character's arc was going to be. He was just going to be kind of like a sycophant that was there at the school. And we just dug working with him so much. And he just honestly made me laugh so hard when we'd work with him that we just started kind of creating this weird, like, you know, sidekick Don Quixote sort of like relationship between these two guys. And, you know.
It's like that line between kind of tragically sad and hilarious is really, that's a tough one to ride.
It really is. And he is just like, Little is just amazing. He's like fearless too. Like we just love writing stuff for him. It's like, do you think Little will get naked and fuck this prostitute? You know, it's like, yeah, let's write it. Let's put it in. Let's see if he will.
You sit there and go, he's doing it.
He's doing it. I can't believe it. The best thing is, like, in the second season, like, when his character's introduced, he's, like, having sex with I guess, Sugar Snap, like, this prostitute. It's the first time we've seen his character. And in the, when we're shooting it, I mean, it's all, like, that's the most hardcore thing at that point we had done in the show. We're like, man, this is crazy. Like, Little's naked. He has, like, a sock over his penis, and he's really just kind of, like, going to town on this chick. And he, you know, when he started improvising, he was like saying, like, look at me, mom, look at me, you know, and it was just the weirdest thing to go to. We're like, that's insane. And what kind of makes it more insane is when you're at the premiere of the show and Steve Little's mom is there, in the audience and just watching her son saying, look at me, mom. And he's it's just so
but
awesome.
But she doesn't necessarily know that he improvised that.
Yeah, no,
that was all scripted, mom.
That was a message to her.
That's nothing to do with you, really. Yeah, the fact that it was improvised makes it even more... How'd you come up with the baby device? I mean, where did that, how did you, when you were like, okay, we got to do another season, we got picked up, where the fuck did we go with this guy?
You know, the whole time we kind of did this, you know, for Jody and I, it was like, we really, even when we set the show up, we didn't want to do a movie version because we thought it would kind of be retreading what we had doing. That 90-minute structure of this kind of story, we thought like the beats that he would have to go through would be too obvious. Like, okay, he's an asshole here, he learned something here, and he's better here. And so for us, we were like, well, this could just be a crazy way to like tell like a 4 or 5 hour story, you know, which we could never get a comedy greenlit that'd be 4 hours long in the movie theater. So for us, we weirdly were pulling from shit like Lonesome Dove and Thornbirds. We were like, this is our, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is our Rich Man, Poor Man. You know, like, this is this insane, insane miniseries. And so we kind of always had, like, we never kind of thought we would ever be able to do more than the first season, really.
Right.
So we kind of wanted the first season to stand on its own. But we had this plan, like, if we get to do this to the way we want, it'd be 3 seasons long. The first season deals with what it deals with. The second season is fucks everything up and goes to another country. And then the third season, he basically has to deal with the repercussions of like getting this chick pregnant at the end of the first season.
So that was all on the table from the beginning.
That was all on the table. But we never thought we would ever even get to the third season. Like, we really thought the first season would be all that we'd be able to do.
So the other country, was it vague how you would get him there initially?
It was kind of vague. We kind of imagined him in the Dominican Republic. And then we went down on a scout there and we're like, yep, fuck shooting down here. Let's go somewhere else.
And you ended up in Mexico?
We actually ended up in Puerto Rico. We wanted to I shot Heartbreak Kid in Cabo, and we were there for like a month, and we all lived in with the Farrelly brothers in this awesome resort. I mean, it was like one of the best times shooting ever. And so I was like, man, we should write this shit.
What'd
in Cabo.
You shoot there?
The Heartbreak Kid.
Oh, right.
And I was like, we should shoot the whole next season in Cabo. I mean, it would be good living down there, but you know, but then all that cartel shit's going on, so like HBO wouldn't let us go down there.
Yeah, it's not good for Americans down there, or anybody, really.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck, that's scary. But Puerto Rico is fun, right?
Puerto Rico is a blast. We had a great time down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right, now, in Tropic Thunder, I thought you were, I loved that role.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
And that, I love that movie.
Yeah.
And that was a smart fucking movie.
It was really smart. I mean, the moment I met Ben on Heartbreak Kid and he told me about Tropic Thunder and like, let me read the script. And I was just like, damn, this is going to be amazing. And like, then once the cast started lining up of all the guys he had involved, I mean, it was just insane. I mean, yeah. You know, just incredible.
Where'd you guys shoot that?
That was in Kauai. So I was there for like 3 months in Hawaii. And you know, that, the first scene of that movie, you know, where it's like you reveal that it's a movie, that was like a 3 week shoot. And everybody was on set every single day.
The war scene.
Yeah, the war scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm standing up in a tower, and it was like, that was the craziest thing, because for 3 weeks, I had no idea whether they were going to get to me or not. So, like, every single day is, like, waking up nervous, just, like, not stomach and knots.
For your first scene.
Yeah, for the first scene.
And what movie was this? Was it, like, your fourth movie? Or?
Yeah, yeah. This was the fourth movie, yeah.
But this was big.
This was big. And there were a lot of big stars in this one. And they didn't get to me till literally the fucking last day of the thing. So, it was, like, 3 weeks. I'm just, like, can't sleep at night. I can't eat any food.
Waiting for your joke beat, which basically was like, now what?
Yeah, exactly. And it was just like, that's what I was afraid of. What the hell's wrong with me?
And that, what was it? You had some scenes with Nolte, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember that was the relationship you had with him.
It was that was honestly my favorite part about doing that movie. It's like Nolte and I had the same schedule, basically.
Yeah.
And we were staying at the same resort. Oh, yeah. So, you know, in the daytime, there, you know, when we were off, it was like, well, Nolte's off too. Maybe we'll see if he wants to go, you know, snorkeling or something.
did he?
Yeah, we hung out definitely on our off times. It was amazing. And he's such a cool dude. I mean, I've been a fan of his forever.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And just nuts. I mean, he comes onto the set and it's like, you know, I mean, he's like doing his own stunts, like running around, jumping. And as soon as the cameras come on, it's just like whoo, glaze comes over his eye and he's just, you know,
in it.
Yeah. It just pretty insane to watch.
Were you a fan of North Dallas 40? Do you remember that movie he did with Mac Davis about the football players?
No.
What's some of your Nolte one? I mean, like the other, like he's been around for so long. He did that Beatnik movie where he played Neil Cassidy in Heartbeats, and like he's been around so long.
Yeah.
Like, what'd you guys talk about?
I mean, you know, he would talk about he talked about how he got arrested when he was in his youth for like making fake draft cards, and I mean he has a lot of pretty insane stories, and
Did you go snorkeling?
Yeah, we went snorkeling.
So you're underwater, you saw Nick Nolte just sort of
sporting to pufferfish. I see it.
That's awesome. And you got to keep a straight face with that shit. You can't just...
Yeah, like, you got to be cool.
But did you have that feeling? Because I get that feeling a lot in the garage, you know, like, you know, you're sitting there, you know, next to your hero, and then all of a sudden you're like, hey, just a person.
Yeah.
You remind yourself, just people.
Exactly. He, and he's just such a nice guy, too, on top of it all. It's like, he really is,
Watching Luck?
I have been watching Luck. I feel like with all those big dramas on HBO, doesn't it feel like it takes a few episodes and everyone
sometimes,
all of a
sudden... Sometimes it takes for it to be off the air after five seasons.
And everyone goes nuts.
Yeah, and everyone's like, I watched The Wire in 2 weeks, the entire thing. Like, because it was one of those things, and the same with Luck or any of them. Like, I never did Deadwood. But sometimes, you know, you're like, I'll try this out, and you're already in the middle of the third season. It's like, there's no fucking way that I'm going to get back, and I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah.
And there's no way to pick up on it.
It kind of excludes you sometimes, yeah.
So I talked to, I might as well just get your side of the story.
Okay. Give it to me.
Well, no, because who was it? Bill Hader? Was it Hader who was on the podcast?
Oh, yeah. He told that story about me smoking weed in the limo.
That's a very good story. It really showed who you were. What happened there?
I think, you know, that we were like watching some movie or for some reason there was a limousine involved. I can't really remember why.
Yeah.
We were out for the night somewhere, and Andy and Akiva had hooked up this limousine, and we were pretty drunk at this point. We'd been drinking all night, and I don't know what happened. I mean, someone had given me a pipe or a bowl.
Sure.
And I'm in the back of the limo, and I hit it, and the driver comes out, and he's just like, no weed in here, you know, and he's upset, as he should be. I shouldn't have been doing that, you know? And but he just like kind of yelled so much, and I just something snapped to me, and right in front of him, I just smiled at him and just hit it again. And he was like, get the fuck out of there. And I was like, you're right. I'm being told I'm so sorry. I can't believe I just did that to you. And got out, and no one stayed with me. All those guys left in the limo, and I'm literally just in Vancouver by myself with this bowl. It's like, oh, I'm like, hit it out here by myself now.
It's funny. Was that one of those moments where you're like, I'm fucking Danny McBride? And like within seconds, it dissipates. You're like, oh, I'm just an asshole.
Yeah, this is just like one of those cocksucker Hollywood moves. What's happened to you?
Oh, it's so lucky you caught yourself.
Yeah, I know. I caught myself. Pulled myself back from the brink.
Yeah, you didn't cry either.
Yeah. I didn't cry. I had grown up a lot. He went in for a handshake, and I hugged him and cried on his shoulder.
Oh, fuck. Vancouver's cool. I was just up there.
I love it up there.
How long did you stay up there?
I guess we were up there the whole summer. We were up there for almost 3 months, I think. Yeah.
It's so cool, man.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
It's a nice city.
Everything shoots up there.
We actually just did some pickups last week. We shot that down in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
So that was familiar.
Yeah. Great. We love working down there. It's awesome. You know, when you shoot in Wilmington, too, there's no direct flights from Los Angeles. So, like, just that layover is enough to scare executives from, like, coming to check up on you.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you got free reign. Like, they're not going to make it down here.
No,
they got transferred to a little plane with no special treatment. They're not going to.
That was almost kind of what the deal was the first season is, you know, HBO really left us alone the first season. They never came down to check on us, really. They didn't really fiddle with us too much. And we came back and started delivering the episodes. And we delivered, like, the first three, and it was just radio silence for like a week and a half.
Really? Was that after, like, because they were transitioning at some point? I mean, Carolyn Strauss was leaving and Sue was coming in. Who were you working with over there?
Well, we sold the show to Carolyn, but then she was gone. So,
right.
So it was, you know, there was a whole new group of people who,
right.
You know.
That's always scary, right?
It is scary because, like, at least with Carolyn, she knew what we were going for. And
right.
So with the new people, you know, it was one of those things where we delivered the first episodes and they were basically like, what the fuck is this? This is like, this character sucks. No one's going to want to watch this. And they were really pushing for us to change it. They just like, they didn't really know what we were kind of going for. And I don't think they thought that it would work. And we kind of got into this little bit of a showdown with them where they were just kind of like, you know, if you don't want to make these changes, then, you know, we might not promote the show. It's not going to be a priority of ours. It was kind of a, you know, I think.
So they're not like, we're not going to pull it because we paid for it, but, you know, we're going to
dry. When they, like, gave it to the press, I think we had heard stories that, like, they just gave the pilot in with, like, the Kevin Bacon movie. It was, like, kind of jammed in the back. It was
like,
just like.
Like an additional DVD.
Here's this little thing.
In the press package for another thing.
It's like a B-side. but then we started kind of getting, like, some positive reviews for it. And I do think as the season went on and they kind of saw what we were doing, they started to get it where those first few episodes are pretty rough, and you know, and they don't really have the arc of the character in there yet. So
right.
As they saw that, they started getting behind it more. And then when we kind of got an audience, like come the second season, they were literally just like, you know what, we had pegged this show wrong. We really dig the show. We support it, and they've been amazing to work with. They let us do whatever we want.
That in and of itself is an amazing moment to hear an executive say, "We pegged this wrong. Clearly, we waited long enough for people to make up our minds for us."
I thought for sure then, well, the next season, they're going to say that they had misjudged it, but they're still going to probably give us the same sort of notes. And it wasn't at all. I mean, their notes were always like, they, out of working with different studios, like HBO's notes are like the best. They're never notes about like, this is too far. They're literally just notes that are like,
what's with his beard?
It's a legitimate note. Like, this beat doesn't make sense, you know, like, and it's the first time I've ever had that with anyone I've ever worked with where the people we're working with completely get what we're doing, and they, you know, they're collaborators on it. Where some of this other stuff we've had to develop, it's like you get these notes and you just look
like
at
what?
You know, when we were developing Your Highness, I can remember, and maybe they were right. We probably should have listened to some of their notes.
But they were at a different point. You're like, fuck that, man.
Well, it's just, you know, whenever you're doing something that's like filthy, like that's kind of the point of it. You know, it's like if you start trying to water it down, it's like, well, you're just going to end up with something that, you know, once I chop the Minotaur's dick off and wear it around my neck, like we're going to lose anybody who's not into the filth at that point. So why trim the filth down throughout the whole thing? You know,
We got to push it all the way out.
Come on.
Yeah. What is some of your, like, in terms of that, like, you seem to be a horror guy and a, like, a fantasy guy, but, I mean, are those, in terms of your comedy and pushing it to that level and staying out there, I mean, what inspired you? What are some of the movies?
When I was a kid, I mean, like, my favorite movies when I was growing up were things like, you know, like The Goonies or Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I love the original Bad News Bears. It was, like, one of my favorite films of all time, and, God, what else? I mean, Ghostbusters, like everything that any kid in the 80s grew up on cable television.
You know, loved it.
Loved it. I mean, I used to like do weird shit where it's like I would take a tape player, and we didn't have any of the pay channels, and I would just like audio record the movies that would play on TV and just like walk around my neighborhood just like listening to Mr. Mom and just
seriously,
like, yeah, I just like loved it.
It's interesting how many people I talk to who have gotten, you know, who have gone on to write comedy and perform comedy have done shit like that. Like, Apatow used to transcribe SNL sketches. Who else was it? Like, there's so many people that did this weird, obsessive shit with comedy. Like, because there's some part of you that thinks, like, there's some sort of magic to this.
Yeah, if I can just, like, embrace my, flood myself with this all the time.
And also the relief of laughing is amazing. Like, were you an isolated kid? Were you, like, that kid who was like, I'm just going to.
I had friends and shit, but, yeah, I definitely had my alone times where I was just like, why is he listening to Mr. Mom again?
Listening to it.
Yeah, like, listening to Mr. Mom, and for whatever reason, Hot Lead and Cold Feet with Don Knotts. That was the other one that I would listen to all the time. I loved it.
Don Knotts?
Yeah.
He was funny.
He was funny, yeah.
But what about serious movies?
I didn't really start getting into serious movies until I started getting into college. Like, I was definitely
where you had to study them?
Yeah, we had to study them. Yeah. And, like,
Intolerance, D.W.
Yeah.
Griffin.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
The montage. Like, oh, fucking.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Is this right? It seems like he wanted the Confederacy to win. It's not about that.
Don't worry about it. Yeah. It's amazing he pulled this off, right?
But Chaplin or any of that shit? Did you have to watch all that in school?
We had to watch that stuff. But the stuff I kind of gravitated towards is a lot of, like, the films like the 70s, like Robert Altman.
The
best. I mean, like, things like McCabe and
Mrs.
Miller.
Yeah. I mean, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I fucking watch over and over again.
He's just so good. And really, his style, I think, is that's kind of what we really wanted to do with what we were doing in comedy, with, like, that level of improv where you could just let these cameras go and just let people kind of just go on these long runs. And, you know, honestly, with
do you do that with
Eastbound? Yeah. I mean, we just almost every single scene we do, we'll set up cameras on two different dolly tracks and just, like, let the cameras rope back and forth, and we just run out each mag and just
really. Yeah. And you just improvise most of it.
We work really hard on the scripts and make sure it's all there on the page,
right?
And once we get, like, a take or two of that, and then we just open it up. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, it's a lot of stuff that comes in the show definitely isn't stuff that we had written when we first set out. And that's what guys like Steve Little and stuff, you know, these guys who can just improv naturally, it just kind of just adds this element to it. As long as those character arcs are there, we're never precious about anything we've written.
He's a Groundlings guy, right?
Yeah, yep.
And he comes from that. Yeah, I mean, how are you with improvising?
I think I'm good at improvising. Maybe it's just the writer in me, but yeah, I mean, I prefer it. I like it better. To me, it keeps it exciting. It's like saying the same lines. I just don't have any, training, really, you know, professional training. So to me, it's just like saying the lines feels like, all right, get this shit done. Okay, now we can start doing it for real. When, you know.
Where do you think that came from, though, your ability to perform? Was there a moment in your life where you're like, I got this?
No, it hasn't. I haven't found that moment yet. I still, on everything, I'm just like, they're going to find out. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, and I'm out.
I think that everybody creatively thinks that on some level. Have you tried any really serious shit?
Because
it seems like you could do it. Like, because you talk about Michael Keaton. You like Michael Keaton?
Love Michael Keaton, yeah.
I mean, I ran into him recently. I've been in touch with him. I ran into him at an airport, and he's, you know, people forget just how fucking huge he was and the amazing thing he did from really moving from comedy into almost anything he wanted. He was the best Batman, really.
Yeah, he was the man.
Wasn't he?
He was.
So do you have any – have you been offered anything where you can
– I mean, I think Up in the Air was probably the closest I've come to, like, really doing something kind of dramatic, even though that's, like, you know –
That was a sweet part, though. That, I mean, that really played to your kind of, like, you know, the cocky but humble guy.
Yeah, and that was a lot of fun. I mean, I definitely would be –
You acted the fuck out of that.
I tried to act the fuck out of it, yeah.
I mean, it definitely read because you have that – there's something that you have which is this kind of, like, you know, that – and I think you're very aware of it. They're because you're not a bullshit artist, but you can play them pretty well, right?
I can.
And that there's that bullshit artist, the bullshit artist with a heart.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, the guy
that's the corner,
the guy who's tired of his own bullshit deep down.
And that thing was, like, one of those other experiences where it's like, that was, that scene with Clooney is, like, the first day on the set, just got
at
to
the bar?
It's the one where.
Or in the schoolroom?
In the schoolroom.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm literally walking on the set, like, Danny, this is Mr. Clooney. And it's like, sitting there, like, and here we go. And it's just like.
And that's the roughest part where he's talking you back into the marriage.
Yeah. And so for me, like some of the hardest parts about these roles are just, like, not looking like a starstruck idiot when I'm, like, being filmed talking to these people that, you know.
And you feel it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It feels nuts. You're just the whole time like, what the fuck am I doing here? This is insane.
That's George Clooney.
Yeah,
that's hilarious. What were you thinking during that scene? That's George Clooney.
The whole time, yeah. This is Clooney. Imagine if I really was afraid to get married and George Clooney was helping me.
Did you get along with him all right?
He was great. I mean, super nice guy. I mean, everything that you've heard about him is totally true. I mean, he was just, you know, couldn't be nicer.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that's sort of like, you know, I can't believe I still love this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, it never ends. You know, like, what's he going to do to make me hate him?
Yeah.
Nothing
at all.
Did you see that Descendants?
I did. Saw it a few times, yeah.
Amazing, right?
Great film.
All right, so you seem like a guy who's had a good time. What's the baby thing? Was that planned?
The baby thing was planned. You know, me and my wife got married a little over a year ago, not this past October, but the October before. And then I planted my seed in her in January of the following year. And so,
do you remember the night?
It was the first time we ever had sex before, only once. And so,
and that's the only time I'm doing. This is the weird part about me, Mark. I just fuck once and that's it.
That's it. You know. And so the night was wonderful.
Thank God.
But it's been a trip, man. It's been insane. I mean, I love it. I mean, it's, you know.
You were ready for the, I don't know what kind of party guy you were.
I partied a lot, but it was one of those, I was just like bored out of my mind. I was ready to stop thinking about myself and start like focusing on something cooler.
Really?
Yeah.
It was that conscious?
Yeah. I mean, it was just I've always wanted to have kids and and it's like, I'm not getting any younger doing this. And so for me, it was like, I didn't want to be like the guy who's like dropping his kid off at preschool. I'm like 65 years old.
Yeah. I'm going to be that guy. I mean, I don't have any kids.
I mean, those guys are fucking cool.
No, I have the same issue. You know, my issue with it is because I've been married twice, but I never had kids. But now I'm with a girl that, you know, she's younger than me. She wants to have kids. But I have that fear because I remember that kid when I was in, like, first grade. Do you remember the kid with the old dad?
Completely. Where it's like, I don't want to spend the night at his house. His parents are like grandparents. It's weird.
Are we going to have to help him? Yeah. What's going to be expected of us? Yeah, I mean, it seems to be popular now because these weird, selfish boomers who, like, you know, were completely careerists all of a sudden are 50. They're like, my life is empty. So you see a lot of them around.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to make myself feel better. But so you have a little girl or?
A little boy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that's good.
Yeah. And, it's like all my friends, I keep in touch with like, all the guys I grew up with. And, to me, it's like, this is brand new, but like those dudes are all so far beyond me. They have like kids getting ready.
Oh, really?
To
you,
high
got,
school
you got,
and,
you yeah. got people on the phone where it's like, what do you do when they're.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because they, you know, back in Virginia, like people start having kids younger there.
Oh, yeah.
It's not
like
the same
when you're 15
deal.
Usually, right?
16. Yeah. It's like, we're weird when we go back to Los Angeles and Kia and I, like my.
When you go back to Carolina?
Yeah. And it's like, we're not married and we're in our 30s and we're just dating each other. It's just
what's
like,
what's wrong with you?
You have a girlfriend? What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, you're in your 30s.
Step up. Man up.
Buy property.
Well, wait, what kind of, so you did that, right? Well, that had something to do with it. You're a little more settled.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you didn't want to have kids in Burbank.
Didn't want to have kids while I was waiting tables at the Crocodile Cafe.
Put daddy's apron down. Oh, he messed up. Can I have a clean apron? Yeah, that's a sad moment. But now I'm going to get emailed about like how I said a boy's good. Girls are good, too, but
yeah,
you got a boy.
They're all cool.
You're going to have another one?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have another one. You know, that way they can just entertain each other. I kind of just want this so that I can not have to do chores around the house. That's
right,
like,
sure. That's
been a plan since forever.
I think
forever.
That's a dad's plan. But what kind of calls do you make to your friends about what have you panicked about with the kid?
You know, he's been a really chill baby. He's like, you know, he in the beginning, he wouldn't cry a lot. At nighttime, he would never wake up crying. We'd wake up, and it's like, what is that noise? Like, that dude is talking to himself. What the fuck is he saying? He's like 2 months old.
Dude, and, Mr. Mom. He's listening to Mr. Mom.
He's listening to Mr. Mom. But he definitely has like found his personality. I mean, but it's just strange. Like today I was like driving in the car on the way over here and like smell my fingers like, oh, some fingers smell like Declan's puke. You know, it's like weirdly stirred my heart.
Well, man, well, congratulations on all your success.
I appreciate it.
And you're a good guy. Thanks for hanging
out.
Well,
thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Wow. Wow.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah, that was something else.
Manly.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, have you seen any of Danny McBride's television shows?
I saw Tropic Thunder, but I haven't seen Eastbound and Down, really. I saw like an episode or two, you know, ambiently. You know, the way you watch TV and something else is on at someone else's place or you're in a hotel or something like that. Something like that, yeah. I always kind of assumed he must be like a funny guy, you know. You?
Yeah, fair enough. I watched Eastbound and Down. Coming from, well, you know, Texas doesn't consider itself as part of the South, which is kind of a joke, but I do. So coming from the South, it definitely struck some chords.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can see that. It's weird that Texas is in the South.
Yep, I went to high school with guys like that. I remember I went to high school with a guy You know, because the guys I went to high school were, they wanted their trucks to be as high off the ground as possible.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Like, so it's hard to get in?
I don't know. You know, it was something about ground clearance, but I don't know what exactly was on the ground that they needed to clear when they were driving from their suburban houses to high school.
Yeah, right.
But maybe there were weekend activities I wasn't privy to. I don't know.
Yeah, they didn't.
Because I was a bit more like Danny McBride. I wasn't in theater. I wasn't crazy. I was the designer of my high school paper. I was in like a music review writing club.
Right. Oh boy.
We reviewed, you know,
Radiohead records.
Recent CD releases.
By Radiohead?
No, just for each other. We just get together every Wednesday, and each week someone would pick a new album, and then we'd write up, you know, a page or so on it, and then share our thoughts and have kind of like vicious pencil neck geek arguments about whether or not Tom York had sold out.
Ouch.
Yeah, we have to understand this was a little bit before internet. Before
you could have had a career,
internet,
dude.
So our main resource was, you know, if you were really lazy, you went to Best Buy to see what the new musics were. And if you were feeling adventurous, you went down to Dallas and went to a place called Bob's Records and Tapes, where this kind of slithery, slimy gay man would hit on you. And if he felt like you were cool or cute enough, he'd maybe give you, turn you on to some new stuff. But then his main thing was Ben Harper. So, you know, like, we were lost. I'm surprised I came out alive at all.
Oh, Ben Harper.
But yeah, no, I was a bit more like Danny McBride. So anyhow, there was a guy who had lifted his truck. So he was rather short and very strong. I remember he had, like, you know, rippling muscles. So you didn't want to make fun of him. Because he's definitely the kind of guy that would punch you. People punched each other a lot where I went to high school. It's kind of scary. He was very strong, and he lifted his truck so high that he had to get a custom ladder made to get into it. I always found that so humorous. Yeah, I remember I parked next to him. Or actually, I didn't park next to him because I had a truck. But I had an old Ford Ranger that was purple. So, you know,
I've heard
nobody thought
this.
I was cool. But I a friend parked next to him who had a Z, Nissan Z from the 70s, a low car. And this guy, John, parked next to him. And he opened his car door. And the car door, the bottom of the car door actually cleared the entire Nissan Z.
That's cool.
Like, he never had to look before opening the driver's side door. Just swing it open. Because chances are you're not going to hit anything.
But, like, what if he gets out on top of someone's car?
Yeah, I don't know why he raised the car so high. The truck, sorry.
Right, yeah. Car. Jeez Louise, Texas. Yeah.
Well, Steve, you know, it's been long, but I did want to ask. I feel like Danny brings up a good Brechtian question of what a character is. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
I guess I never think about it. Literally, it's just like a name, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think most think that a character is just, you know, a pure product of the imagination. Obviously it's more subtle than that.
Or like less.
Yeah.
Like just like a sign.
Anywho, I feel like my brain is a little fried from all that macho talking.
Totally.
So be safe. I'm going to go check on my car.
Yeah, make sure your car isn't burned down.
Get you back to the airport, Steve.
Totally.
All right.
Drive me back to LAX.
Have fun back in Texas. Yeehaw. Good morning, Chinatown.